Hi, I'm Melissa Quirkum. I blog at our family website, www.thequirkums.com, which we affectionately call The Quirkboard. This is the Uncorked Podcast, conversations with everyday extraordinary people, people who have conquered, people making a difference in their worlds, brave and beautiful people, but people who in the end are just like you and me. If there's one thing I've learned over the past 10 years, it's about how much I didn't know that I didn't know, and how much I still don't know. Our experiences in adoption and loving kids who have aged out of the foster care system, living in the country but owning a coffee shop in the city, and just traveling internationally have so greatly expanded our horizons and shifted our paradigms. And hopefully, we're better humans for it. The one common theme through all of those experiences, though, was just listening to people's stories. Patty Dye once said, "The shortest distance between two people is a story." So pull up a chair and an open mind and meet another one of my everyday extraordinary friends.
Happy New Year. Welcome to 2018 and episode 15. Today I bring to you Hope Forte, who is on a mission to change the face of foster care in Colorado and beyond. Besides everything foster care, we chat about the shame of having to end a placement and our opinions of birth parents. We also chat about all the things the village, that's you, can do to make a difference. So here's my conversation with Hope.
Well, hi, Hope. How are you?
Good. Thanks, Melissa.
I am so glad that you are here for this week's episode. I'm so excited to get to know a little bit more about your story.
Thank you.
So I guess just start by telling us kind of who are you, how do you identify as a person, as a mama, kind of what your day-to-day looks like, and then introduce us to your family.
Well, I am a proud Coloradan, and actually only for the last 6 years we've lived here in Colorado, but that's one of the first things that comes to mind because I'm looking at my husband's pair of skis that he just got out for the first day of ski season. It's big out here. Everyone loves the outdoors. And I would say I do, probably most of your listeners are the same. I definitely form my identity around my family and our home life. And I do pretty strongly identify as a foster mom too, even though we don't have kids from foster care in our home right now. I have my husband and my son who is about to turn 4, though he wishes he was turning 10 because we had a preteen foster kid last year, and so he idolizes being older than 4. So
that's great.
He's a funny kiddo. And my husband and I both work for ourselves. He owns a public relations firm, and then I am working on a foster care project. So we really enjoy working from home, and it's kind of funny because we both have pretty intense lives, but also because we're self-employed, we can have a decent amount of flexibility, which that's probably what you do with your business too, with the oils and everything. And so we enjoy being home and being flexible, but trying to get a lot of things done and trying to meet a lot of people and make connections during our work time. But one of the things we've really been working on this year is juggling our childcare, since we're not fostering right now, juggling the childcare for our son between the two of us. And that's been a fun thing to work out and something we feel really lucky to be able to do being self-employed.
Yeah, you're like living my dream life, self-employment, which we dream about all the time. I am self-employed, but my husband isn't. And so I think really we always think like it would be so great if you could just blank. And he's an IT guy, so really we keep thinking we should just take our show on the road and do something adventurous. But Colorado,
it's hard to make the break, though, because then you have everything's on your shoulders. So it's like there's the up and the down. So he has, you know, for instance, 4 employees that he pays before he pays himself. And, you know, if it's a lean month, then we make it work. But, you know, we have chosen that because for us, the benefits outweigh that kind of adventure.
Yeah. And that is exactly why we're still in corporate America.
Exactly.
For those exact reasons.
Stability.
Well, and I was also going to say Colorado is one of the few states that I have not been to, but like top of my list. So a huge problem that I need to solve fairly quickly, I think.
I'd love to meet you. And if you ever, Yeah, and if you ever come out, I have to introduce you to my friend. The first reason I found out about you is because my friend who lives down the street is an adoptive mom, and she once sent me, I think I told you this before, she sent me your cancer blog post, why we should treat foster adoptive families like they have cancer. Is that's yours,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah, that was mine.
And she said, I just really appreciate you treating me like I have cancer. And so she and I talk about all of the stuff you put out, so we'd have to go out for happy hour together.
Oh, we are going to make that happen somehow, sometime soon. I don't know how, but yeah, if I'm ever in your neck of the woods, I will certainly look you up. I feel like all the cool people are in Colorado, so I really need to get a trip out there. And then all the ministry headquarters are in Colorado.
Yeah.
I grew up listening to Adventures in Odyssey, which tells you how old school and how
Same.
Christian normal I grew up. And, of course, my kids love it as well. And so that is on our family bucket list. I think at some point we'll do a road trip and visit Wits End. But
they've got a pretty cool setup out here.
I imagine.
The family visitor center. Not everyone likes that they, you know, it's very politically divided thing, but they do a fantastic job at a visitor center.
That's
for kids.
Amazing.
It's very fun.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So tell me about foster care. How did you guys arrive that was going to be part of your family story?
Well, it's kind of a four-part thing, which each part is really important to me. The first thing is our son was born, and I realized that people talking about the power of parenthood and the power of those early connections and those early things kids learn from their parents is no cliche. It is absolutely the most vital thing that happens in human relationships, as I know you know.
So much pressure.
And, yeah. And feeling that power and feeling every kid needs this much. Every kid needs this kind of attention and deserves this kind of attention. And I was actually, we were thinking before we had our son of overseas adoption. I don't really know why we thought about that. And this is another important part of the story for what we're doing now. We didn't think about foster care, but it was kind of like when he was born, for some reason, our focus switched to local stuff. And I started thinking, okay, these kids are in my neighborhood and they're in Colorado. They're in Colorado Springs, which is where I live. Actually, funny enough, mentioning all of those nonprofit headquarters and ministry headquarters you mentioned are in Colorado Springs. It's known as a very conservative place, but we actually have the worst child abuse and neglect in the state. And I don't know what it was that started me thinking about that, but I thought, okay, that's too scary though. Like, I'm not going to go that far into foster care, but what can I do that's really substantially helpful? Not just giving money, not just, though that's very helpful, not just dropping off teddy bears at Christmas time, but what can I do that's really helpful? So I found out about CASA, which to me was, it's court-appointed special advocates. You're matched with a kid. It's almost like a mentoring program, but for the older kids, but you also have a voice in court, and you represent that kid in court, make sure things don't fall through the cracks. So to me, that seemed less scary than foster care. And so my husband and I signed up. We went through training together around the time our son was 6 months old. And then by the time we went through training, they said, okay, since you're a team, we want to give you a big family to be CASAs for. So we had six kids on our first case, siblings. And when they were still at home, but there was a point at which they were about to be evicted from their house because the landlord was unhappy with how the kids had kind of torn it apart, and the mom wasn't paying as much attention as they needed, which is part of why the case was open as well. And we kind of saw the power of community in that moment, because we pulled together, and this is what you can do as a CASA if you have the time, creative thinking that really fixes things that the system can't do. So we pulled together people to come in and donate paint so that the mom could paint the house, the inside of the house. New carpeting was donated and installed for the family. We had people come fix the cabinets that were falling off, things like that that helped them avoid that eviction and actually prevented all six of those kids going into foster care and definitely being split up in foster care. So that was like, wow, we could actually prevent some pretty significant trauma through this. At the same time, meeting those kids, we realized they're not necessarily as scary, kids in foster care. It's not necessarily this huge, scary group, but it's individual kids, and maybe we could actually try fostering. So even though we were trying to avoid fostering, it ended up leading into it. And then the last part of that story is we found a wonderful podcast called the Foster Parenting Podcast by Tim and Wendy, and they had like 60 episodes of kind of their daily life and their infants and their how they got their first and second and third placement, how their adoption went. I listened to the entire series in probably 3 weeks, and I think that day-to-day understanding of what their life looked like was what made me say I could do that too. So that's our whole story.
Hmm.
4 different kind of sections there.
Yeah, I love how that kind of all weave and fit together like a puzzle.
Mm-hmm.
And
yep.
Let me just tell you, 6 kids in any house, no matter how well they're being supervised,
yeah.
is just totally wreaks havoc on a house. When all 6 of our kids were at home, things broke at rates that were just astonishing. That in the 10 years that we had been married and been household odors mm-hmm. had never broken before, broke when all 6 kids were at home. And I can't say that it was like one particular kid or even a behavioral thing. It was just like mm-hmm. usage, just, I don't know, straight up like wear and tear. It was just crazy. So I can't imagine being in a situation where you kind of already feel like you're underwater, you're in a tough situation, and then you have all this pressure to, you know, a landlord. Fortunately, you know, we own our home, so there's no one to come behind us and be like, you really should get that bathroom up and running. Because let me tell you, there's a lot of things going on in our house right now that are really not pretty. So, yeah, I love that idea of community, and I just think we're all just one connection away or one lack of connection away from like impoverishment and destitution.
It's changed how I think about that. I used to think about, it was great that I had parents that cared about me, but I could just pull myself up by my bootstraps if I ever needed to. And I don't really think the same way anymore about the
crazy.
Parents in the system.
Yeah, how when you start getting in relationship with people that are just in different paradigms as you, it just blows everything you thought you know out of out of the water.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
super
it's really good humbling. For humility.
Yeah,
exactly.
Right.
Yeah.
At
the same time.
So you're not fostering now, but
you
have fostered. What has that looked like for you guys? How was that experience? Because you did some things coming up to that. You didn't go in blind. You kind of knew. Kind of some of what you were getting yourself into because you had interacted with other families as CASA volunteers, you know. So kind of what have placements been like for you? Have there been really big surprises? Have there been, I know there's been blessings, but, you know, what have been the surprises, the hard things, the easy things?
We went in thinking that we had one kid already, but by the time we were certified, our son was about 1. And so that whole process I explained earlier was about 1 year. And we went in thinking that because we already have 1 kid, why not just go ahead and foster siblings too? And I'm thankful for the fact that we happened to get one of the more, I would say, significantly trauma-informed agencies because everyone in our county actually goes through a private agency. And we chose them for that reason because they were really thoroughly trauma-informed and it wasn't just lip service, but they are pretty adamant about not doing just behavior modification. And
Can I stop you for a second? Just what does trauma-informed mean to you? I know what it means to me, but just for folks who are listening who maybe aren't in foster care or in orphan care, what does trauma-informed kind of look like, and why was that important to you?
We knew going in that you can't just expect a kid to come into a more stable home than what they're coming from, and everything's going to be okay, and they're going to be thankful, and they're going to trust you. But when you're dealing with a background of abuse or neglect, which all kids in foster care have at least one of those 2 things, they're going to be harder to what the average person would say, manage or deal with their behaviors. Because, and that's the stereotype, I think, of foster kids in general. They're hard kids is what people might say. And that's sometimes true, sometimes not. But in general, we knew we would need more than, you know, you go in knowing you can't spank a foster kid, but which is not a parenting method we would have probably used anyway. But what are you going to do when a kid is screaming for the third hour in a row? So it's these really specific ideas of, let's look at the behavior behind the need behind the behavior, instead of let's just fix this kid and make them adjustable to society. And so helping them heal rather than just saying, buck up and be part of this family in the way we want you to. So in one sentence, it's helping the kid heal from the behavior, from the needs that they have, and meeting their needs rather than just saying, you need to perform and do the things we want you to do. Does that make sense?
Yeah. Yeah. And I think one of the things that we started learning, and actually probably learned too late in our journey in some senses, was that it was not a given that kids would want to be in a quote-unquote better environment. That they, like we look at where kids from foster care or kids who are available for adoption come from and think, clearly it's better where they're going.
Yeah, and so they'd be so grateful.
They should, right. And even if they don't feel grateful, they should at least act more normal or something. I don't know. That sounds so ignorant. But
and sometimes it's more scary for them to have a stable place.
Yeah, and I did not fully understand that until way too late.
I didn't either.
In our story. So anyway, okay. So you went with a really great trauma-informed agency, which
we have a good reputation for that. But I think our mistake was, we are already parents. We've got one kid. What's two more? And so we said we'd take sibling groups of two, and our son was 1.5, and we said anything up to age 6. And when we got our first placement, you know, we had actually just moved about 60 miles away from where we'd been for the first 3 years of our marriage, and just for a job thing, and didn't have any of our people around us. And that should have been, I think, a red flag to us and to the agency. But then when we got the call, they said, two girls just got picked up from a hotel, no behavioral issues. And we were not smart enough to think, well, they just got picked up. They've never been picked up before. So, of course, they don't have a record of behavioral issues. But there was some violence toward our son that made it unsustainable. And we actually, the biggest shame in our life is that we had to give what's called give notice on them, which means you ask them to be moved to another foster home about 7 weeks in, because we weren't able to keep our son safe. And so I would say that was our biggest learning curve. And I think a lot of times your first placement is just going to be like that, because you don't know what you're looking for and you don't know what you're able to handle until you kind of get into it. But I think we could have, I just tell people, start really slow. And there's plenty of kids who need one, you know, plenty of single kids that need a placement. So maybe just start with that. I would say biggest joys and biggest surprises have been how, even in this system that is mind-blowingly poorly structured and overlooked, I would say that the power of one great caseworker or one great support friend, like the person in your treat foster and adoptive families, like they have cancer posts, or one great relationship between us and the parents of the child we're fostering, that can make a lot of those systemic problems go away. For instance, a lot of foster parents in Colorado don't know that it is actually acceptable for them to show up to court, to show up to almost all meetings, and that they should be allowed at almost all of that administrative stuff. And I think, of course they should, because even more than a therapist who's with the kid an hour a week, if we're spending, you know, 24/7 with this child, we should be speaking into what kind of the team is, what kinds of things the team is deciding on. Not to say that we get to make the decision, but to definitely put input into what this child is like. So that kind of problem that I see in all the different counties in Colorado, DHS is doing a big push to get foster parent feedback, and that's one of the big things. Like, we're not allowed to go to this stuff. Well, they really are, but when you're in touch with, for instance, the child's parents, and that parent is inviting and saying, please come to court because I think you have a good picture of where our family is, that takes away that. Then if the parent is inviting you in, you're almost always guaranteed to be allowed, if that makes sense, even though you're already technically allowed. That those human connections between people is, those are what have made it a really, not a horrific experience, where I think if we're just us and them with the foster parent, or if we have a case manager who isn't very responsive, I haven't had bad luck with that, but I know people who have, I think really great people and great relationships can go a long way to avoiding a lot of the systemic problems. I'd say that's been the biggest surprise.
Yeah, definitely. So how do you find those people? That's like the $1 million question.
Yeah, I got lucky with, I've had some really great GALs, for instance. GALs are the lawyers for the kids. I think, and that's not something foster parents get to choose. I do think this is kind of side note to what you just asked, but I do think starting out as a CASA, a court appointed advocate, and then going into the foster parent role, you kind of just assume that you're going to be heard, and you would just assume that your voice matters because you know the kids so well. And so that attitude might be part of that. But and so I don't know that it's finding people so much as kind of presenting the reality that you're hoping to get to with the children's parents or with the professionals on the team, and then hoping that they're responsive to that. And I think more than anything, people are expecting negativity in the system. And so if they find somebody that's open and not judgmental and not suspicious all the time of them as either, I find that to be a common attitude toward both professionals and parents of the children in care. If you're just going in with a little bit more of a light attitude and withholding judgment and assuming the best, I think of that that verse in the Bible that says love believes all things, believing that this person is in it for the good of the child, even if evidence would say that it's not what you would have done for that child, that creates those relationships. There's not much choice, though, in who gets put into your life, which is kind of the fun part for us, because we would have never met most of the people we know through foster care if we hadn't been involved.
Yeah, what I love about
that. Our circle would look pretty homogenous.
Yeah, and what I love about that, and what I'm really learning about my parenting journey is we have exactly what you said. We have control over ourselves and our attitude.
Mm-hmm.
And we have very little control over circumstances, who the world and, you know, providence puts in our path. And
Sure. And
so much of that I look upon differently now because I can change my attitude. And And not underestimating yourself and your voice. I hear you saying that too. Like, don't underestimate that you have power in the situation, that you can be heard by the courts, even if it, you know, history would say foster families may not have as big of a voice as we would like to think. And to just go for gold, you know, have high expectations for what the difference that you can make. And I think giving everyone the benefit of the doubt is such a good life lesson overall for all things. But I can imagine that that makes the connections that you're making within the foster care system that much more viable. And it really changes your experience overall and how you experience the system and the brokenness of the system.
It does.
You have a choice.
Yep. And I think another thing that surprised me is I don't, and I think part of this is why the power of storytelling is really important to me, but part of this comes from how Tim and Wendy in that podcast I mentioned that they did, you know, 2008 or something, and I just happened to find the archives, but they kind of set the expectation with a couple of their episodes that it can be a good relationship between you and the child's parents, and not to go in with that attitude of antagonism, I hope that's a word, antagonistic attitude, and then I haven't had a parent on one of my cases that has been a villain that just wants the worst for their child. I know that those people are out there, but I have not had them yet. And that's actually changed how I view the system. I think I probably went in much more strongly wanting to adopt than I do now. And I think part of that is because I've realized that, especially when we had a 12-year-old last year who really wanted to be with his mom, and, you know, I have trouble sometimes with the current marketing of foster care because there's a lot of rescuing language. There's a lot of adoption motivation, which is totally legitimate because, like, in Colorado, for instance, 40% of the kids will be opened for available for adoption. And so it's a true thing that happened. But I've changed my attitude about it, or not my attitude, but my expectation about adoption, because I've just seen if these parents are at all willing to do that, they call it in CASA training, minimum sufficient level of care. So they're not being abused and they're not being neglected, but it's a different kind, different level of care than a person in my position would want to expect from my child. I don't want to take that child and adopt them. I want them to be with their parent who cares about them and loves them, and I don't want to be, I don't want to put myself up as the hero in that situation, because the hero should be the parent who's doing the work. And I think, I just wonder if we change some of that language around foster care, would we see more successful reunifications and more empowered parents rather than this kind of feeling of dejection and depression?
Those are really good thoughts and a lot of nuances and a lot of things that we've tossed around as well. And there's mm-hmm. no easy answers. It's so hard.
Right.
But I think one of the other things that really connected with us as we were kind of understanding trauma and relationship mm-hmm. trauma and kind of how that looks behaviorally. And it just all of a sudden hit me that these birth parents are kids from hard places grown up who never had someone understand them. And so when mm-hmm. I think about them just needing the same resources that their kids need, my compassion level really changes. And mm-hmm. at the same time, you know, it's sticky because it doesn't mean that they're always safe parents or,
right.
you know, all of those things.
And we do see kids who go home and then come back in for good reason.
Yeah.
For
yeah.
terrible reasons, but for legitimate
right.
reasons.
Legitimate reasons, for sure. But it's tricky because it's a big thing to, mm-hmm. you know, kind of forever separate a child from a birth family. Mm-hmm. And so it's not – I struggle in the same ways kind of with the marketing aspect of foster care. And because mm-hmm. I know, too, that it's not sunshine and rainbows all the time. So mm-hmm. it's hard to kind of use that imaging, you know, that foster parents just, you know, foster parents just need to open their homes or just need to X, Y, or
just
Z.
Just need time, I think.
Yeah,
one headline. So all you need is time.
Yeah, it's so much bigger than that. So, which kind of mm-hmm. brings us to what your current project is. So you're currently not fostering, but you're actively advocating. And so mm-hmm. what is this project that you're working on? Because that, when I heard wind of this, this mm-hmm. is when I thought, gosh, I need to get with Hope and hear her story and hear more about what she's doing, because it so resonated with where we are in our thought process in orphan care and all of those things.
Yes. We're starting Foster Together Colorado, and it's born out of our own foster care story, partly that first one where we didn't have the support we needed, and where we, even though we did a lot of research, we still had, I would say, more of a sunshine and rainbows view of things, even though we had that trauma-informed care training, like I explained. And the main goal of it is to, and it's also born out of our positive stories, what I just mentioned with when you have a really great human connection where you have the expectation that things are going to, people are going to listen to you or things are going to go well, rather than doom and gloom, which we also have in foster care marketing, and lots of stereotypes about that, things will probably go better. And so we're trying to do two things. One is change the story of foster care by letting foster parents, we've kind of been calling it like a little more edgy approach, or like public relations for foster parents, where it's not just a family profile or a little snippet about a family, but something like, we've got lots of kind of sample headlines we're playing with, where we'd make a big media splash and do headlines like, the first time I hugged a drug addict, and that's your story about having a positive relationship that was beneficial to the child with that child's parents. Or we have mm-hmm. a story call about, this would be my story, I've fostered 4 children and I've never rescued one, but why I do it anyway. And then, because I don't feel comfortable running a public relations or advertising campaign, an awareness campaign without a call to action, I want to have baby steps for people who are in the general public, because this will be a lot of people's first impression of foster care, beyond big numbers, like we need 1,000 more foster parents in our state, which is something that's happening right now, or, you know, 20 kids in Colorado are abused and neglected every day, things that feel really scary to people and really like, let me leave that to the professionals. I couldn't make a dent in that. So making that relatable and then inviting them to do something simple to help a foster family. And that's really more for them to be bought in than it even is. It'll help the foster families, but it's almost more to get the general public doing something, because we know they'd care if they had a relatable story, and we know they'd do something if it was simple. And so things like the most simple thing that we can that they can do on our website so far is sponsoring a meal, a monthly meal delivery for a family. And that ties the story back in, because we've got, you can sponsor for $40 a meal for a single foster parent. We've got a lot of single foster moms and a few single foster dads in the state. And let's sponsor a meal for $40 a month. They'll know they get this gift card or this delivery that will make them feel celebrated and breathe a sigh of relief and just have that much more capacity to parent for that day. All the way up to, we're just really playing with the idea of getting a county or statewide respite list going. I can't believe we don't have something like that already, but I've been talking with a few great people who've been in it for a long time who are interested in starting something where we've got people who are not fostering, because foster parents are already too burned out, but they're still just doing respite for each other because, you know, people just say, oh, no one else has the background check or whatever. And we're like, what? It's $50. Why can't we, you know, sponsor that and get a list of really awesome people who can do that for 1 weekend a month or 1 weekend every 2 months? And having a list rather than foster parents having to scramble through their agency or through their own friends to get that kind of respite. And so the goal is really just those baby steps for the general public to start being actively aware and actively engaged.
Yeah, I love that. What was like, is there like a single moment or single act of service that you received while you were actively fostering that stands out to you from someone who, you know, just knocked on your door or called you and offered something in the line of service?
Yes, it was when we had the 12-year-old that we were fostering. I had to go to his therapy appointments with him just in case something went wrong and he wasn't able to handle the session. So I had to stay there the whole time. And at the time, our son was just barely 3. So this was earlier this year. And he was still napping in the afternoon, and I really wanted him to be able to nap because everybody's happier when the preschooler takes the nap.
Absolutely.
And I had a friend who said, you go to the therapy appointment with him, and I'll stay here and sit at the house so that your kiddo doesn't miss his nap, because it was a pretty long therapy session, and it was just a mess when I had to pull him out of bed, get him in the car, take him to the session, sit there with him for 2 hours in an office that nobody was really excited about having a preschooler running around. And so it actually gave me some time because I could sit and read or do some work while I was waiting for the therapy session to be over. And my son got his nap. And that was, you know, 2 hours of the day that I could kind of, even though I was at the therapy office, do what I needed to do. And then also, of course, respite, especially that first time with the little girls. The respite is what allowed us to catch our breath and it was seriously emotionally draining and pushed us to the edge in some ways we'd never been pushed before. And so I think it kept us from some pretty drastic actions during that time, just to have 2 days off. And we actually are great friends now with the people who did that respite for us. And I love how it connects people. So I'm trying to figure out how to do that in a way that's manageable for a small nonprofit.
Yeah, absolutely. I love that idea. I love your edgy kind of PR campaign. I can't wait to see more of that. I'll be your biggest fan for sure.
Thank you.
I just wanted to go back to that. You touched on the girls again, your first placement, and you said something that has been a little bit of a passion of ours just because we've had to walk really hard roads and do things that I never dreamed in my wildest imaginations that we would have to do as an adoptive family. But reframe what you said when you had to, you know, end your placement with that first set of girls, how shameful it was for you guys. Have you been able to reframe that for yourselves since that's happened, as you've kind of gotten your feet a little bit deeper into the foster care world? And what would you say to families who have had to change a placement, end a placement, either in foster or adoption, who are just feeling like they can't ever show their face to the adoption world again?
Yeah. I grieved the girls for about 9 months, I think, because I felt so embarrassed, and I felt like I was 7 weeks into being a foster mom, and I was already the foster mom I said I'd never be, which is the one who sends kids away and starts them on this. My friend the other day just called it a placement mill. And I felt like I'm the problem in foster care, people like me. And I think it took about those 9 months. And then I think around Mother's Day, I woke up one morning and I didn't feel that that weight quite as much. I mean, it was the kind of thing where previously I was probably crying about it once a week and just waking up almost every day feeling guilty and heavy and missing them like I missed my, like they were my own children that I had committed to and then sent away. And I think a few things happened. One was that they ended up, the next placement, they separated them because they actually thought that that was part of the problem. And then after that, they ended up going to family. So part of that was probably not something that many adoptive families will have the relief of, but knowing that, A, they were quite the pair, and even experienced foster parents weren't able to handle them together, and then B, that they ended up with family and they would have ended up there anyway. So that would be helpful to foster parents, but not so much probably to adoptive. I think the other part is that it sounds lame, but we didn't know going in. And I think we were not, I don't think we did not have a conscience that told us you were not as careful as you could have been, because we felt like we were being as careful as we could with the information that we had. We felt like, you know, we had just checked, you know, no sexual perpetration, because for our son's sake, and no, you know, wild, violent behaviors. And that's what it kind of turned into. So we still felt like we went in saying that we couldn't handle violence. And I would say part of the thing that relieved it was knowing that the system didn't set us up to be thinking, okay, yeah, they said no behavioral issues, but come to find out 1 week in, they have exactly one of the two behavioral issues, which was extreme violence that we said we couldn't handle. And so I guess, I don't know if there's a better way to say it than we were able to say this is a predictable outcome with a broken system that isn't quite preparing people enough for the nuances of what does no behavioral issues mean. And I think we learned a lot from that. But at the same time, that's a common story with foster parents. And I think with adoptive parents too, you don't know what's going to happen once you get a kid home. And And we don't feel bad about making sure our son remains safe and relatively at peace. I mean, he's with our next placements, he's had some big turmoil in his life, but not in the way that he was physically in danger with that first time. So that responsibility to him was something that helped us rationalize over the months of doubting our decision.
Yeah. Do you ever think, looking back, like, we should just wait till he's old or doesn't need us or out of the house and then we would foster? Or do you still feel pretty strongly that this is a part of your family story and that, you know, whatever, you know, within reason and boundaries and safety, that mm-hmm. we're, you know, that you're still willing to take in unknowns and kids into your yeah. family? Because that's something that we've really wrestled with. We brought, we adopted out of birth order, and, you know, we obviously wouldn't change it for the world just because we believe in God's providence, and there's been a lot of beauty in the ashes, but we have definitely had really hard conversations about, you know, what would we say to people who are thinking about fostering or adopting out of birth order?
Right.
So what are your thoughts on that now?
It's changed in that, well, the most basic thing is after that we said only one at a time. We're not doing siblings again, and we're not, because especially with where we are in our careers and having to focus on that and then how young our son is, we can handle chaos from one kid, but I don't think we can handle it from multiple. And so, like, learning that about ourselves. And what we actually had planned to do after that was just take little babies, like 2 years younger than our son. And we had a newborn, and then we were actually CASAs for this 12-year-old that we had last year. And he needed a placement. He needed to get out of residential. He was ready. And we went into that one with eyes wide open. And that's something I would tell people before I would say don't foster. I would say, here's what you do. If you are having any child other than a tiny baby, where your only thing at that point is going to be, at that point, I emphasize, is going to be, you know, withdrawals or something like that from the baby. If you're having a kid who's going to have behavior that will be challenging, make sure you have your resources in place before you, for foster care, before you actually take the placement. So because that was so out of our requested age range, our agency said, no way, and because we had disrupted before, they said, no way you're taking him until we have the first therapy appointment on the calendar. And that's something that doesn't usually happen. And so the logistics of it and us, like, learning what we can do and what we need before has been good. I would say we're definitely more cautious about saying yes, we'd adopt than we were before we started. We probably had more of a idea of, if it's ever a need, we'll totally do it. And now we've deliberately said no to that on the last two placements, because for the baby, because we thought his mom was able enough, and for the 12-year-old, because he wanted to be with his mom, and we didn't want to handle the behaviors long term. And so it's changed that, and it's changed how we view our power going into it, as if there is something that can be done, how can we make sure it happens now? Because we know, and I'm sure this is true with adoptions too, we know once the deal is done, people are going to stop paying attention, because they're just going to be like, okay, that kid's taken care of, you know. But if we put a deadline and we say, we'd love to take this hard-to-place child, I don't like that label, but I just said it anyway, but what we need first is this, this, and this, then usually they'll come through. So does that answer the question?
Yeah, for sure. And I love that idea of, well, actually, I don't love this idea at all, but I know, I agree with what you said, that, you know, outsiders often view the adoption process kind of ending at placement, especially in international adoptions where there's fundraising and there's a long wait. And, you know, your life, yeah, a lot of your life, mm-hmm. you know, revolved around that story, the pre-placement story. And it's a time of excitement and celebration and anticipation. And a lot of people, the hype ends, you know, once the child comes home. And really, that's when the story really begins. Mm-hmm. You know, all that hype and the pre-placement stuff is really a preface to a much, much longer, longer story and book. And we found that with our story was that it's hard to keep people engaged post-placement. And some of that has to do with the fact that we wanted to protect our kids and their stories. And
people, you mean the professionals or your friends?
I would say both, actually. You know, we have, and I don't want to throw our friends under the bus because we have a close group of friends that has stuck with us through thick and thin, and we would not be where we were without them. But I felt like there was just this outpouring of support that I wish I could have bottled and saved for about 2 years in post-placement. And, you know, just like you said, simple things like meals. We didn't need them as much the first 2 weeks home. We had older children and they weren't eating much anyway, and they were only eating
And you have an adrenaline rush.
Yeah, and we were really, we were good. But like 2 years in, you know, we were not, no one was eating in our house because when you're in crisis, it's like, it was the first thing I stopped doing was cooking for my family. So, but it's hard to, it was really hard to figure out how to advocate for ourselves because we wanted to protect our kids' stories and we didn't want to throw them under the bus.
And it was hard. And say, this kid is causing these problems.
And it was hard to help. It was hard for people to understand what desperate situation that we were in without throwing them under the bus. And we felt like, and this is our own pride coming in too, we felt like we couldn't just say to people, we need meals or we need people to fold our laundry. It just sounded like, if we didn't have something to back that up, it was ridiculous. And
they're just asking for handouts, grifting, whatever.
And we have amazing, amazing friends. So I'm sure if we had just asked those things, people would have done it. But, you know, you just, you spend too much time on social media reading stories and you just feel like we can't ask for those things. You know, that's just ridiculous. And again, our pride said that was ridiculous. Don't ask for those things. So, yeah, I am such a big fan of what your vision is for fostering together. I think it's a beautiful marriage of how to have a different conversation about foster care and still call people together to support the families that are doing it, because I think it's really going to be the make or break of foster families. You know, we families are not going to get into it unless they can have support, and they shouldn't get into it unless they have support.
Especially with more and more dual income households. We don't have as many stay at home parents right now in the country because of the cost of living. And if and in Colorado, there is no child care. So if you are either paying out of pocket, unless you can get into Head Start maybe, but our low-income child care assistance does not apply to foster families at this time. And so there's that's out of pocket. And we get about, it's for a young child, it would be about $16 a day to reimburse that. But that's much less than the average day in daycare.
Clearly, $16 a day. That's awesome. Well, in closing, if you're running your PR campaign for Foster Together, what is the main message that you would want, the nuanced message that you would want to go out to the public about foster care? Because we're hearing a lot right now when we're recording. It's National Adoption Month in November, and this will probably air sometime in December, but there's all of these, you know, unicorn and rainbows, like I like to say, PR about fostering. And so you already shared some of your statement, what you think the message should be instead. If you could craft that, what would it be?
I would say that the most important thing I would want people to know about foster care is that being involved at any level will enrich your life. Not in that unicorn and rainbows kind of way, but in the way of knowing, if we know this kind of suffering and this kind of human pain is going on in the world, as people who are often I hear, you know, in our articles we share on Facebook or whatever, oh, this is such a disconnected age. This is such a time where there's just all these crises around the world, but everyone feels powerless to help. And this is a way that we can be in that pain with someone and have authenticity in our lives and have real human connection in our lives, whether we are fostering or supporting a family. And to me, maybe not everyone thinks like this, but I'm speaking to the people who want that kind of dose of reality in their life, whether or not they're fostering or supporting a family. And they want to be part of the pain relief for some of the deepest kinds of human pain there is. And I'm not saying fixing, but I'm saying the most substantial pain relief someone can have for that kind of trauma is another human being saying, I love you in this, or you're worth spending time on in this. And I think that is the foster care can be a conduit for that kind of human connection.
That idea that connection is the final outcome that we're looking for, not fixing a person or a family. And I am such a fixer. And so that is something that I am really having to learn while parenting our kids from hard places. And that idea of, I just love that theme of connection, human interaction. And I'm sure that there's a really edgy tagline in there somewhere about getting out from behind social media in order to get involved in foster care. And there's no small or large parts. Like, I feel like people need to hear that the person who's bringing a meal, like, that is no small feat. And
because
that is really not... Yeah, and it's not less than opening your home. That there's no less than action in this equation, that everyone that's doing something is infinitely significant to the solution.
Yeah, and to take it to a practical level, in Colorado, we're only keeping our foster families for 2 years, and then they quit for a variety of reasons. But if we're the person that's making it possible for us to have another year or 2 years out of those foster parents, then we're, I mean, I even had a, I'm doing a lot of respite right now because we're not fostering actively. And I had a mom tell me 2 weekends ago, if you never do anything except respite, you will be helping so many families keep kids. And,
I believe it.
I totally agree with you about that. It is, there's not a small part in it because the demands of adoption and of foster care are so significant that we need that extended family. And I think people are hungry for that kind of thing. So now I just have to figure out how to efficiently match families and help them, you know, get a match with a support person and make that process go well.
Yeah, I love it. So where can we find Foster Together for people who want to connect with you, want to know more, or possibly start something similar in their state?
Yeah, I'd love to hear from anyone, especially with, I'm sure your listeners have tons of great ideas. So they can go to our website, which is fostertogether.co, as in Colorado. I didn't buy the .com because it was an extra couple thousand dollars. And so also they can email me at connect@fostertogether.co. So I'd love to hear from anybody who has ideas or inspirations or questions.
I love it. Well, Hope, thank you so much for being here. I am just huge. I'm so excited for what Foster Together is going to do, and I'm positive it's going to have just a huge impact. And I'm hoping that it happens all over the country, all over the world, really, but specifically, I'd love to see, you know, Foster Together and then every state listed after that. So thanks so much for being faithful, for stepping outside of the box, for doing the hard things, for being honest, for, you know, being a great learner of as you walk through life. And so I'm just really so thankful that we got to get to know each other a little bit better and then get to hang out with me.
So mutual. I just love everything you put out. So thanks for I see a lot of faithfulness there, too, because I know the thanklessness of sometimes publishing those posts and wishing they got a lot more feedback or whatever it is, but I really appreciate the voice you are.
Well, congratulations. You are my number one and probably only fan, so I appreciate you in my fan club.
Except for my friend. Oh, good.
We can be a fan club of three.
Yeah.
I'm a fan. Well, hope have a great evening. And again, thanks for being here.
Yeah.
Guys, I just love the edgy way Hope is thinking about foster care and how her thinking has the power to shift the paradigm. I love the way she's deliberate and intentional and creative, all the things that don't always define how our family has moved forward. I can learn a lot from her, for sure. I'll have a link to Foster Together Colorado on the show notes page at www.thecorkums.com. As always, I love to connect with you on Instagram, Twitter, or Facebook. My username is M.A. Corkum. One way to help Hope spread her message is to leave a review for the podcast on your favorite podcast app. This helps more people meet our everyday extraordinary guests. I hope you come back next week when I'll bring to you an everyday extraordinary mama who went back to law school because she saw a place where she could make a difference. As always, thanks so much for being here every week, and we'll see you next time.